You have been sabotaged. It is early afternoon. You've just eaten lunch. It's warm. And then to throw everything else on top of it, they've dimmed the lights. You have been sabotaged. You have a great struggle this afternoon, I know, to stay awake and to pay attention. However, let's make a deal. You do that, and I won't preach until midnight. So that's our deal. Okay. So earlier this week, I was having a conversation with one of you, and you happened to mention some people you know that are agnostic. And it occurred to me, I haven't really done a sermon on agnostics, and I wanted to do one. So we're going to talk about agnostic considerations this afternoon. And with that, it actually is pretty much the same sermon as this morning. Different substance, but it's the same end. This morning we talked about confident salvation. When we talk about agnosticism, we're fighting with somebody who says they have no confidence. And really the answer is we can have great reason for our confidence. Now, I want to talk about what an agnostic is really quickly, because not everybody knows that. That's not a term we use every day. It's pretty simple. An atheist is somebody who doesn't believe in God. An agnostic is someone who doesn't believe we can know. And they actually come in different levels. They apply that philosophy in different layers into their spiritual life. So, for example, there are those who are the most basic agnostic. That is someone who believes we can't really know if there's a God. Maybe there's a God, maybe there's not a God, we don't know. And then there's others who kind of come to the realization there's a God, but we can't know which God is God. And so there's been all these gods that have been worshipped throughout time, and there's no way of knowing which one is which. And then you have what I would call Christian agnostics, people that believe that the God of the Bible is God, but we can never know who's actually following him. That is, we can never know who's actually interpreting his scriptures correctly. All of those are agnostics. They're just agnostics on different stages. Now, we're going to focus primarily on the first two this afternoon. We could talk about the other one on another occasion. But we want to talk about people that think that we can't know if there's a God and we can't know which God is God. I want anybody who's in that stage, Christianity is absolutely the religion to focus on. Christianity is unique and special in that it really deals with this level of agnosticism, giving us cause to tilt, not in this area where we can't decide, but to tilt all the way to an area of decision and confidence in our decision. Here's the question that needs to be considered for an agnostic. All right. An agnostic shouldn't just be satisfied with not knowing. They need to consider this possibility. If there's a God, and they haven't ignored that possibility, so if there's a God, wouldn't he, as God, have the power and ability to make himself known? So they're starting off with the idea of, well, we can't know if there's a God or not, which means you actually ought to be pursuing the concept of maybe there's a God. Has he revealed himself? Because if there's a God who wants to reveal himself as God, he's got to be able to. He's got to be able to reveal himself in such a way that people can know he exists. Now, if there's a God who doesn't want to be revealed, there's no way you'll ever know. There's nothing you can do to find a God who wants to hide. He's God, after all. He's got all this power. He can hide. But what if there's a God who wants to be known? And that is indeed the God of the Bible. Now, in the Bible, we know that it is necessary for us to have faith to be saved. We talked about that this morning, about the necessity of faith and the plan of salvation. Well, faith is a real problem for an agnostic. To them, that's kind of like their baseline proof that says, see, we can't know if there's a God because your God requires that we believe rather than that we really know. And I believe that at the root of this is a misunderstanding of what faith really is. If people really believed that idea that said, if we have to believe in something we can't really know, their life would shut down. They would be incapable of functioning in this world. We act upon faith constantly. Our system of government is built entirely on faith. Faith is not as people think, that it is blind. Since we cannot see God, then faith must be blind. That is not faith. Faith is not blind. Faith is based on evidence. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, not Hebrews 1 and verse 1, Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, it gives us the definition of faith, and it uses courtroom terms. It says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Every day in our courts, we are doing exactly that, convicting on somebody we have not seen them commit the crime. That's always the case in our court cases. The jury never witnesses this person committing the crime. They would be thrown off of the jury. We don't want that. We want it to be something where they are impartial. They have not seen, they don't know, and then we present evidence after evidence after evidence and then say, do you know? And if they are convinced by the evidence, even though they didn't see the crime, they say this person's guilty. That's faith. It's not blind. It's a conviction based on evidence rather than on actually having witnessed something. I'll give you an illustration within the Bible of a doubter. In John chapter 20, we have Thomas, who we frequently call the doubter, and that's probably not the most fair thing in the world. In fact, all of the apostles doubted Jesus' resurrection at some point. All of them doubted it at some point. Thomas just happens to be the one who holds on to the doubt the longest. Thomas has all the other apostles come to him and say, we have seen Jesus. He's not dead. He's alive. He lives once more. And Thomas says, I don't believe you. In fact, I refuse to believe you until I get evidence, very specific evidence. So he says in verse 24, Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples were saying to him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see in his hands the imprints of the nails and put my finger into the place of the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. After 8 days, his disciples were again inside and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, reach here with your finger and see my hands. Reach here your hand and put it into my side. And do not be unbelieving, but believing. Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. Jesus said to him, because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed. And so here Thomas now has seen his evidence. And what is it still called now at this point? It's still faith. And he has tremendous confidence, and for good reason. He has now seen the holes in his hands, the hole in his side. This is not some imposter. This is not somebody wearing a costume. This is, in fact, Jesus. And he falls down and comes to this conclusion, not just that Jesus is alive, but that Jesus is my Lord and my God. And he's not in an agnostic way of saying, I'm not so sure right now. I can't know for certain because I've never seen you in heaven. He's not saying that. He's seen enough evidence to be convinced. It's still faith. But it is faith that is absolutely certain. And anybody can be absolutely certain based on evidence. And so yes, the Bible requires us to have faith, but that is not a reason for us to hold on to agnosticism. It's a reason for us to test the evidence. And that's something you need to understand about the God of the Bible. And this is how this is different than pretty much any other religion I'm aware of. The Bible cares about this. God cares about you being certain. He wants us to have reason to know. And so what we find is that God has laid clues in the world. He has laid clues all over the place so that people can come to know and understand who He is. Romans chapter 1 is a famous passage in this regard, and also very important. We're going to come back to it again in a little bit, but Romans chapter 1 verse 18 says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. How did He do that? For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. One of the most basic reasons I believe in God is the universe that is around me. And I'm not just talking about beauty. I'm talking about the detailed nature of it. I'm talking about the power that is within it. I'm talking about the order. It wasn't too long ago that Randy was up here on a Wednesday night, and he drew out the basic living cell, the most basic living cell. And in that most basic living cell, you have thousands upon thousands of procedures that are occurring in like clockwork every second. There is order in everything around us. Everything around us, despite so many people that are atheistic, everything around us is screaming to us, there is a God. Not everybody listens. Not everybody understands the evidence. But understand that God has created things in such a way that we will see and we will be convinced He does exist. And by the way, as much as you might think that all scientists are atheists, that is simply not true. There are many scientists who are not atheists, and in fact, there are many scientists who aren't atheists because they are scientists. Because in their search of understanding the world around us, they stopped and realized the explanation of evolution does not work. And they have come to believe in God simply because they searched the world around them. And they found His signature all over. The character of God. Our God works in such a way that He wants us to know, even in the context of all these other gods. I use this one particular example in Exodus, but there could be so many more we could look at. But in Exodus, we have the gods of Egypt, and they have lots of gods. And then there's the God of the Hebrews, the God of the Bible. And Moses comes to Pharaoh and he says, let my people go so that they can go worship God. And Pharaoh's response is, who's God? I don't know this God. Why should I do this? I don't care who He is. And then we have the beginning of the plagues. And with the plagues, we see this common theme keep coming up. Exodus chapter 8 and verse 10. In regards to the frogs, God gives Pharaoh the opportunity, tell me when to make the frogs disappear. I'll make them disappear like this. When would you like that to happen? Here's the reasoning behind it. Exodus chapter 8 and verse 10. Pharaoh says, tomorrow. So he said, may it be according to your word that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. It's going to happen just like you said, so that you know there's no one like this God. In verse 22. But on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen where my people are living so that no swarms of the flies will be there in order that you may know that I, the Lord, am in the midst of the land. And so here we have God revealing Himself saying, I'm doing this so you know I exist. And so you know those are my people and I am here and I am watching and I am listening. In chapter 9 and verse 14, for this time I will send all my plagues on you and your servants and your people so that you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth. In verse 29, perhaps you're getting the trend here. Moses said to him, as soon as I go out of the city, I will spread out my hands to the Lord. The thunder will cease and there will be hail no longer that you may know that the earth is the Lord's. Again and again and again. And then it's not just here, but throughout the Old Testament, God repeats this concept again. I'm going to do this so that you know I'm real. So that you know not only I'm real, but I am the God of all gods. Our God doesn't want you to be uncertain. The God of the Bible wants you to have reason to believe. And so in Acts chapter 17, here again we have all of these gods. In fact, we have an agnostic God, the unknown God. In Acts chapter 17, and so Paul is going through this city and he's seeing them worship this God and worship this God and worship this God and this other God and this other God. And then they have this God that's the unknown God. And he says, I want you to know the agnostic God. I want you to know the unknown God. And so he says, the God is not like the gods that you think of. He's greater than that. He's better than that. But then he finishes his sermon. In Acts chapter 17, verse 30 and 31, it says, therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent because He has fixed a day in which He will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom He has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising Him from the dead. So our God doesn't want us to be unknown, to not be certain. Instead, He has furnished proof. That word proof, by the way, is actually the word for faith. What He has done is He has furnished faith. He's given us the reason to believe in Jesus. He confirms the message time and time again. When the apostles came to a new city, it was not something where they came to the city and said, I am just so amazing, you should believe everything I say. Instead, God gives confirmation of their message. Hebrews chapter 2, verses 3 through 4. I think that's hard for us to wrap our minds around. Those of us who believe, we know the apostles were inspired, and so we just assume that. That was not the way they came into a city. That's not the way they approached most churches, saying, I'm inspired, so accept it. Instead, their message was frequently confirmed. He says, how will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? After it was first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us by those who heard. God also testifying with them both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit according to His own will. And so here we have a God who wishes to confirm His message, make it certain, and who testifies to us what the truth is. You need to understand, this God's not like other gods. This God cares about you being certain. And I'll finish off with this in 1 John chapter 5 and verse 13, towards the very end of this book. John says, here's why I'm writing. These things I have written to you who believe in the name of the Son of God, so that you may know that you have eternal life. That book was written so you could know. These things are written as evidence so that we will believe. So then we must consider the evidences. All we've done here to this point is say that Christianity is different. It's the religion you should look at because it's the religion that wants to prove itself to you. Unlike every other religion, this one wants to convince you based on the evidence around, evidence you can consider, evidence you can test. So what is the evidence for the Bible? Now here is where, if I had more time, we would go into much more detail. But I already promised you, and you're doing pretty good, promised you I wouldn't preach until midnight. So I'm going to talk about subjects vaguely. We're not going to get into all the specifics, but this is the reason you should investigate Christianity. This is the reason that those of us who are believers should have tremendous confidence that we're not just following a religion, we are following the religion. Not just a God, but the God. And the first reason is because of miracles. That was the evidence for their times, for the people that were right there. I mean, I tell you, I don't know how you doubt Jesus when He resurrects people from the dead. I don't know how you doubt Jesus when there is somebody who has been lame from birth. And by the way, you can't be lame from birth and not be physically, obviously that way. The legs just haven't been used. They're skin and bones. And then Jesus is able to heal these people, and His apostles are able to heal these people. In fact, in the Bible, it's described this way. The doubters couldn't deny the miracles. Now, they might deny the implications, but they couldn't deny the miracles. I'll give you one example of that. That's Acts chapter 4 and verse 16. We had read for us this morning, verses 7 through 12, where Peter has said, there's no other name under heaven by which you must be saved than the name of Jesus. As they consider what has happened, this is one of those cases where a lame man who's been lame from birth has been healed to where he's now jumping up and dancing around for everybody to see. But it says in verse 16, well, pick up verse 15. But when they had ordered them to leave the council, they began to confer with one another, saying, what shall we do with these men? For the fact that a noteworthy miracle has taken place through them is apparent to all who live in Jerusalem, and we cannot deny it. They would love to deny it, but they couldn't. When you look at the miracles, when they occurred, they were of such a nature, nobody could deny the miracles. That's a little different than television miracles today. When somebody comes up and says, hey, this person has a hearing problem, I'll put my hand on their forehead, and I know you've never met them, but you're just going to have to trust me. They have a hearing problem, and boom, and they fell down, and now they can hear. Oh, obviously a miracle's occurred. No, that's nothing like what we see within the Bible. These miracles were profound and undeniable. Why do I believe in the Bible? The evidence is of the prophecies, which is the evidence for future times. In other words, a prophet made a prophecy that something was going to happen way down the road. That doesn't really convince the people of that time, but sure does later. It's one of the reasons why so many Jews should have become Christians. It's when they started to look and see everything the Old Testament had talked about happening hundreds of years later in their time with Jesus. A great illustration of this is with Psalm 22. They read Psalm 22 so many times and they didn't know what it was talking about. And then all of a sudden, here on the cross, they don't know what to think about Jesus, but he quotes Psalm 22. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? And they maybe they would go back and read it and all of a sudden read something about what they're witnessing all over them. It was being fulfilled over here. It was being fulfilled over there. All around them, these statements back then suddenly come into sharp focus and they realize long ago, somebody from hundreds of years ago saw the events they were now seeing and they should have become convinced of who Jesus was. And it should work the same for us today too. The Bible, hundreds of years before things occurred, prophesied about kingdoms falling and kingdoms rising. It prophesied about who would be the names of certain kings and the things that they would do. And the biggest prophecy of all is that of Jesus. Throughout the Old Testament, Jesus is talked about from beginning until end, and he fulfills all of those things. And that's one of those evidences there's no explanation for. There's no explanation for it. And you want to know what most scholars have to do? They recognize that there's no explanation for prophecy, so guess what they have to do? Try and make it to where it's not prophecy. Try to make it to where these books that were written hundreds of years before Jesus weren't written hundreds of years before them. Why? Because they don't want to believe the evidence they cannot deny otherwise. The prophecies convince us. Jesus explains this in John chapter 14. It doesn't have to be a long time in the future. As Jesus is getting ready to go to Jerusalem, everybody's expecting him to become king. They're expecting him to conquer and take his seat on a throne. And instead, Jesus is trying to explain to them, I'm going to go and I'm going to be crucified. And then I will be resurrected. He says, now I have told you before it happens so that when it happens, you may believe. I tell you what's going to happen in the future so that once it happens, once the future comes, you'll find your evidence to be convinced. The third and very, very important evidence is the evidence that applies these two things to our time period. This is the evidence for all times, and that is the evidence of witnesses. In a court case, we bring a witness forward, says, I saw this person do this. And we consider, is that person a reliable person? And then another person comes in and they swear, they tell you with an oath, that person, I saw them commit that crime. And you line up as many people as you can, and at the end, they turn to the jury and say, do you believe them? And sometimes the jury looks and says, you know what, I can see why this person would lie. This person's going to get something out of this situation, and so I can't trust their testimony, and so I don't believe their witness. But on the other occasions when they say, I can't figure out why this person would lie, this person's telling the truth, this person is sacrificing and going through difficulties to tell us these things, I believe them, and we become convinced based solely on witnesses. Well, the witnesses of the Bible is not one book as we think of it. It is not written by one man. It is not written by a few men from one time period. It is written by witnesses. People wrote the Bible over a 1,000-year time span. Longer than that, they write the Bible, each one adding their own little piece, telling what they have seen, what they have experienced, and it all combines to make one account, one thing that points to Jesus and points to salvation and points to truth. And we have all of these witnesses combined that stand up and tell us, this is what I saw. Now you have to decide, can you trust their witness? Now some people might say we can't trust their witness because they talk about miracles. But fortunately, we're talking about agnostics. And an agnostic must accept the fact that those things could happen. They don't know if there's a God or if there's not. But if there's a God, he certainly could do miracles. So we don't discard it just because they talked about miracles. Because what if there actually were miracles? Then consider, what do the people get for writing the Bible and for confessing their faith? Are they made great kings and given great riches? Instead, when we see Paul and we see so many others, we see them suffering and dying for their confession, for their witness. Paul says as he talks about the apostles who were sent out for this. Go witness to everybody. Tell everybody you've seen Jesus live. Paul says, I know what that's going to result in. I know that we are doomed to die for our witness. And yet they keep talking. You tell me, can you trust what they say? Are they reliable witnesses? But this one is like its own little sermon right here, because you'll notice it's perfect. It's got 3 points. And what happens if you have a fourth point? Well, it's a bonus point. And so I have a bonus evidence. And that is the external evidence. Not every time period has had the external evidence, but we have. We have a time period in which people have delved into the world, digging into the dirt, searching for history in the past. And in so doing, they have given us bonus evidence. And there is a lot of it. The Bible is unlike any other book because of this. There is no other religious book that I have seen that merits a book like this. Now, I know this is small print. You can't read it. This is a book that you can buy at the British Museum in London. At the British Museum in London, it says, through the British Museum with the Bible. See, the thing is that all the other religions, there's evidence in the past the religion existed, not evidence the religion is true. And that's a difference. Here you have a book that says you need to see that throughout this whole building and all of its floors, there are little things here and here and here and here that corroborate what you find in the Bible. And it basically boils down to 3 things. As you go through the British Museum, and it's not the only museum, you can go through Chicago's museum. You can go through other major museums in America and other museums around the world, and they are filled with biblical truths and facts and evidences, and they come down to 3 things. They reveal that the Bible talks about real places, real people, and real events. What I mean by that is you can find, I'll give you one illustration of real places is like really simple. The Bible talks about a city. You have everybody, wake up for a second. How many of you have maps at the back of your Bible? How many of your maps have cities on them that the Bible mentions? How do we know where they are? Now you raise, you put your hand down because you can't raise your hand for that one. But we find the places. We have these maps because these places are real. Some of them still exist today. One of them, really obvious, Jerusalem. Still right there. In fact, we can find the first century road that Jesus walked upon. We can find the first century road that Jesus walked upon and the indentions of the rocks that fell down from the temple being destroyed like Jesus prophesied would happen. Real places, real events. Real people, we can find a rock that talks about Pilate. Remember Pilate? Jehu is in the British Museum. We have a picture of Jehu. I'm actually going to go through. Bonnie and I, we bought this book. The British Museum is big. These things are spread out. And we didn't have a lot of time. But we went through and I got a picture of just about everything it mentions in here. And I hope to go through and talk to you about some of them in the future. And thanks to our new picture thingy up there, that's my technical term, our new picture thingy up there, you'll be able to see the pictures better than we have before. So I'm looking forward to that. We'll get to that. But real people, real events. Now I want you to contrast that with one of the only other religious books I can think of that compares to the Bible. And what I mean by that, that has similar form, that blends the religious with the historical, that tries to say, here are the big events that have happened in the past that God was doing. And you know what the only book that I have found that is similar to the Bible is? It's the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon reads very similar to the Bible. It talks about all sorts of things that happened in the Americas, starting from the flood up until recent times. It talks about all these things that happened with the angels and with God and even with Jesus coming back here after he was resurrected, his teaching that he came here. It talks about wars and it talks about cities, and the people have dug in and they have searched. And you know how much you can find in the museums about Mormonism? Zilch. It has no real places, no real people, no real events. Not one has been found. And when you put it in contrast to what you have in the Bible, it screams to you, the Bible does, I am from God and I am the truth and you should believe it. Unlike any other religion in the world, this religion doesn't accept agnosticism, but instead convinces doubters to believe. It's amazing what we're a part of. So I want you to consider this. If there's a God who wishes to be known, how will he respond to those who say, we can't know? So if you go back to Romans chapter 1 and verse 18, here's this passage in which it's telling us that God has revealed himself in nature, in creation, saying, I am real. I have designed everything. I have put things together. They work together for a purpose and in a reasonable way. But how he starts that in verse 18 says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against, and he go on, and it's against the people that deny him. God has gone through so much to prove to us he exists. The people that say, I can't know, aren't safe. They're not okay. They find God's wrath. Didn't you listen? We find out that you can't be a fence sitter. You can't say, well, I don't know, because you cannot please God unless you become convinced. Hebrews 11 and verse 6, we talked about it this morning, again this afternoon. Without faith, it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to him, to God, must believe that he is. It starts off right there. You've got to have that faith or you can't please God. An agnostic cannot please God as long as they hold on to their doubt. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 30, Jesus makes it clear there is simply no fence sitting. You see, I believe an agnostic is somebody who's really trying to ride the fence. They don't want to be so offensive as to say there is no God. They don't want to be so religious as to say there is a God. And so they try to walk that line and say, we can't know one way or the other which is the truth. But Jesus has said there's really no fence walking here. Jesus has said in Matthew 12 and verse 30, he who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters. You either need to join Jesus or accept the fact that you are against him. Just accept it. So an agnostic, you need to understand the Bible, God of the Bible, speaks to you. The things that make you say, I don't know, are the things that he wants to convince you you should know. And so of all the religions in the world, this is the one to examine. This is the one to consider. Do not be satisfied with not knowing. Investigate and come to a conclusion. The Bible is either from God or it is not, and there is no middle ground. It is either truth or it is error, and there is no middle ground. And I trust that you will come to the right conclusion if you will investigate it honestly and carefully. Don't listen to the doubters. And I don't mean that exactly like that. I'm not saying don't only listen to the people that believe. What I mean is, when you're talking about looking at archaeological evidence, things like that, don't listen to the people that just dismiss the Bible right out of hand and say it's all a bunch of myths. Those are people that don't know anything. You're listening to people that know nothing. It cannot be myths. And many of the people that study the Bible, that don't know the Bible, don't believe the Bible, can tell you that can't be. It happened too quickly. We talked about that with 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians happens in the first century. Way too fast to be a myth. And it indisputably happens in the first century. But I also want to warn you about another thing, and this is something that happens on Facebook all the time and all these other things. Don't be too quick to listen to the overly zealous Bible believers either. The archaeological ones, the ones that say, we found the ark, we found something else. Listen to the ones that actually are scholarly, testing and examining and looking and digging, and not the ones that are just trying to prove their point. You will find that the Bible reveals itself to be true from those unbiased sources, many of whom do not believe in the Bible, but they recognize that it still gives guidance to truth. But the people that just dismiss it out of hand, they'll convince you that it's just it's a joke and not even to consider it. The people that tell you everything is true, the problem with them is they're so frequently wrong, and when they're proven wrong, your faith will be put in doubt too. I said not till midnight. So we'll wrap this up. I appreciate your time, your attention. You did a great job. Thank you for staying awake and fighting against the real battle that you've been faced with this afternoon. If you're not a Christian, I hope that you will understand. If you're not already convinced, go out and search these things out. The Bible is a book that has reason to believe. God is a God that has given us reason to believe. Examine the evidence. Do not just leave here and let this message go away. Go out and test it and prove it. And if you're a Christian, if you're not a Christian, you've already realized, yeah, I'm fooling myself here. It is obvious that I believe the Bible. It is obvious that it is true. Well, then why not start following it? Why not set aside your sins and follow Jesus? Why not be baptized this afternoon? And if you're a Christian and you have fallen away, you know God is real. Why would you test Him? Why spend even another moment away from Him? Come back before it's too late. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?